to the Hadavar Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hadavar Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the modern Zionist movement. He will continue to examine the people and events that God used to bring about the modern state of Israel. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now let's begin lesson number 8. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Let's begin lesson 8 of our study, the First Regathering, Modern Israel. As we finished up lesson 7, we were right in the middle of a very momentous year in the history of modern Israel. We were looking at 1920. A lot of very, very important things happened in 1920. The first thing that we covered was the fact that the British were granted the mandate over the land of Israel. Also, we looked at the at that very important event where Tel Chai and was attacked, and Joseph Trumpeldor, key man in the modern Zionist movement, was killed. The Arabs rioted in Jerusalem on April 4th, 3-day rioting. As a result, Sir Herbert Samuel was made the High Commissioner and sent to the Holy Land to represent the British government. In addition, Weizmann was elected president of the World Zionist Organization in 1920. And then a foundation fund called Keren HaYesud was also established to try to meet the financial needs of the Yishuv. That's where we came to an end our last lesson. Now let's continue on with the founding of the Histadrut. In 1920, the Jewish Labor Federation of Palestine, the Histadrut, was also formed. Now, the essential post-war impetus for the Histadrut was supplied by two political factions, the Achdut HaAvodah, the Union of Labor, and HaPoel HaZair, the Young Worker. These are two labor groups, Achdut HaAvodah and HaPoel HaZair. The two labor groups settled their differences and tried to create an apolitical, a non-political, purely labor federation. So on that basis, the Histadrut was founded in Haifa in December of 1920. The federation placed its heaviest emphasis on creating work opportunities for Jewish workers in the land. The Histadrut organized unions, but not simply among manual laborers, but among clerks and technicians and doctors and lawyers. In 1923, the Histadrut established a central economic corporation, the Chevrat Ovdim, the Workers' Association, the Chevrat Ovdim. It functioned as a cooperative wholesale society to buy products from the kibbutzim and the moshavim, and in turn, through a chain of retail stores, they sold the village foodstuffs, the clothing, the industrial goods. In 1926, the Chevrat Ovdim organized a marketing outlet, Tuvna, for kibbutz and moshav dairy products, and then a workers' bank, the Bank HaPoalim, as its major credit instrument for the farm settlements and the labor enterprises in the cities. The Chevrat Ovdim's housing company, Shikun, provided workers with flats at a very low rentals, non-profit rentals. Now, the Histadrut's most important innovation was its program of universal medical coverage. This was known as Kupat Cholim, the sick fund. It had been launched way back in 1911 with some 2,000 participants by the eve of the war. By 1930, its membership had climbed to 15,000. This would double to 30,000 by 1935. The Histadrut formed a school network in 1921. In 1925, it founded its own dramatic company, Ohel, and it began publication of its own newspaper, Davar. The Workers' Federation also launched a number of its own industrial companies. The most important of these firms was the Solel Bonet, the paving and building company. This company drained swamps in the Jezreel and Hula valleys. This company built roads, erected housing, erected office buildings, and in the process opened up thousands of new job opportunities. As early as 1930, the multitude of these activities drew into the Histadrut fold three quarters of the Jewish working population of Palestine. Nearly all phases of a man's life, nearly all phases of the life of his family were embraced by this vast canopy of the workers' organization. Now our next subject will be the growth of Jewish self-defense. Let's take a look at that now with the founding of the Haganah. Now an important consequence of the Arab uprising in this year, the year 1920, was its effect on Jewish military activity. Now the tradition of self-defense went back to Hashomer. Remember that? We talked about Hashomer a while back. This was the Jewish Watchman's Guild of the early 1900s, about 20 years earlier. After the war, however, these members of the guild, the ones that had survived Turkish mistreatment, were prevented by the British from bearing arms. A self-defense effort was initiated by Jabotinsky during the 1920 riots, but it was suppressed by the British mandatory authorities. Shortly afterward, the Achdut HaAvuda, the Union of Labor Party, appointed a special committee to establish a more widely based and secret clandestine self-defense organization. And they simply called it Haganah, they simply called it defense. So the Achdut HaAvuda appointed a committee to establish this defense organization. It was understood that it would be very broadly based. The entire yeshuv would fall within the circle of Jewish security. Therefore, as the Histadrut assumed responsibility for the Haganah, officers' training courses were organized, weapons were purchased illegally from Europe and smuggled in, and eventually secret armories were built for the production of light weapons. When we advance to the year of 1929, we'll encounter more Arab riots. And the riots in 1929 were the critical juncture of the defense program. It was evident now that training would have to include the most of the able-bodied Jewish youth in Palestine, and that newer and more modern weapons would have to be secured. So operating out of a single room in Histadrut House in Tel Aviv, the Haganah's headquarters became the embryonic Ministry of Defense. By 1936, it was receiving larger quantities of income from Jewish agency funds. It was accumulating a number of illegal weapons, and it was enlarging its program of military training. When renewed Arab violence broke out that year, the Jewish military leadership decided at first to try a policy of restraint. In practice, this meant simply that Jewish communities would be defended vigorously, but without acts of retaliation against Arab villages. However, Yitzhak Sadeh, he was the Haganah field commander, Yitzhak Sadeh placed his own interpretation on this concept of restraint. He included in his philosophy the idea of preemptive strikes. So he is more aggressive in this concept. His young officers included such teenagers as Yigdal Alon and Moshe Dayan. It was Sadeh who taught his youthful commanders to plan ambushes, to organize mobile patrols, to anticipate Arab marauders by striking first. The shift from purely defensive to preemptive tactics was made feasible by an agreement newly reached with the mandatory government. Even before the worst of the Arab attacks, the British had raised no objection when the Jewish community accumulated a certain quantity of their own weapons for the protection of outlying farm settlements. As fighting gained in intensity throughout 1936, the Jewish agency demanded additional free legal equipment to protect its isolated farms, and they demanded recognized status for their own guards. Now, the mandatory administration was hard-pressed for military manpower, and so they granted these requests. Light weapons were distributed to some 3,000 authorized gafirs. These were uniformed Jewish auxiliary guards who had parallel membership in the Haganah, and the British accepted the fact that they were part of the gafirs and part of the Haganah. They had dual membership in both organizations. And even more significantly, the man appointed by the British as operating commander over the Gafirs was Captain Ord Wingate. And Captain Ord Wingate vigorously and imaginatively enlarged Sade's concept of an active defense. Now we'll pick up Ord Wingate and his contribution to the Haganah when we get to 1938. So that's a quick look at the beginnings of the Haganah. Let's return to the year 1920, and we'll take a look at another major event. In fact, it's the I believe it's the last major event I want to cover in 1920, and this is the election of a National Assembly. Some 20,000 persons, more than 70% of all the registered Jewish voters, participated in the election of the National Assembly in 1920. So the National Assembly formally opened in Jerusalem in October of that year, October 1920. Sir Herbert Samuel was impressed by this evidence of Zionist communal purpose, and so he offered the National Assembly certain functional latitude over Jewish religious, cultural, and social welfare activities. And so there was real power and authority granted to the National Assembly. 1921 was the year of the 12th Zionist Congress and some more Arab riots, this time in Jaffa. In 1920, there had been a major Arab riot in Jerusalem. We looked at that just a few minutes ago. And during that year, Sir Herbert Samuel took up his position as British High Commissioner in Israel. Remember, he was obsessed with impartiality. And his obsession with impartiality led to conciliatory gestures being extended to the Arabs. This action encouraged Arab nationalism, and Arab restiveness continued to grow. Renewed trouble began in Jaffa on May 1st of 1921. A ragtag group of Jewish communists marched through the center of town in the wake of a Zionist labor parade, and this served the Arab nationalists as a useful pretext. So they rioted. The violence extended immediately to the countryside, and soon Petah Tikva and other Jewish farm colonies were besieged. By the time British troops finally suppressed the last attack at the end of the week, 47 Jewish people and 48 Arabs had been killed, several hundred people on both sides wounded. Now the riots in Jaffa emptied this port city of Jewish inhabitants. The population of Tel Aviv jumped from 3,600 to over 10,000 because of this incident. In the shocked aftermath of the bloodletting, a commission of inquiry was immediately appointed to conduct hearings. At the hearing, the full spectrum of Arab grievances was ventilated, including the repugnance felt by Muslims for Zionist social ideals and the disquiet shared by all Arabs at mounting Jewish immigration. The Commission's final report made little effort to veil its essential sympathy for Arab resentment. More alarming from the Zionist viewpoint was Sir Herbert Samuel's decision to temporarily concede to Arab demands by stopping Jewish immigration. The ban was lifted shortly in July of 1921, but the ban was lifted under more rigid controls. Now, although at London's insistence, this was London, England had insisted that the text of the Balfour Declaration be incorporated directly into the San Remo Mandatory Award. In spite of that, there were growing reservations being expressed at the government's pro-Zionist policy. Attitudes were changing in Great Britain by the end of 1921. March of 1921, he journeyed to the Holy Land. Then and there, to Arab and Jew alike, he firmly repeated his support for a Jewish national home. However, his tour resulted in the separation of Transjordan from Palestine and a reclarification of the Balfour Declaration. Now, at this time, Emir Abdullah appears on the scene. This is Sharif Hussein's oldest son. In March of 1921, T.E. Lawrence and Churchill revived an idea that they had discussed earlier, and they made an offer to Abdullah. The offer to Abdullah was as follows. He would establish an orderly government in Amman. He would recognize Transjordan as an integral part of Britain's Palestine, and he would administer the territory in the name of the Mandate. Abdullah accepted the offer, And there he established an Arab government east of the Jordan River, on the east bank of the Jordan River. Now, the establishment of an Arab government east of the river was Britain's first admission that Transjordan was included in the zone of Arab autonomy. In other words, the large parcel of land that was originally set aside for a Jewish national home was now a large portion of that land, the land all to the eastern side of the Jordan, was now turned over to Arab government. So in Britain's thinking, restrictions were being placed upon a Jewish national home. The Jewish national home was now reduced to the land on the west side of the Jordan River. Let's move to 1922 and the Churchill White Paper. In 1922, more restrictions were imposed on the Jewish national home. In May of 1922, Herbert Samuel returned to London to impress on the Colonial Office the need for dispelling Arab fears on the Palestine question once and for all. This could be established only by, quote, a definitive interpretation of the Balfour Declaration, he insisted. We have to clearly interpret the Balfour Declaration. So a statement of policy was drafted, mainly by Herbert Samuel himself, for issuance over Winston Churchill's signature, known afterward as the Churchill White Paper. The document restricted the Jewish national home to the area west of the Jordan. It avoided the notion of creating a predominantly Jewish state, and it limited Jewish immigration to the, quote, economic capacity of the country. So these were new restrictions on the Jewish national home. Now, the restrictions imposed no severe hardship on Jewish immigration during the early years of the mandate. But it was ominous to the Zionists. What was ominous to the Zionists was the precedent established for conceivably more drastic limitations in the future. Now, the Zionists were fearful of losing British support altogether, so Weizmann and the Zionist executive reluctantly signed the Churchill White Paper. The Arabs, on the other hand, flatly rejected it. Nothing doing. The mixed reception notwithstanding, the government published the Churchill White Paper on July 1, 1922, as the official interpretation of the British mandate in Palestine. Now, on this basis, too, the mandate won swift acceptance in the House of Commons 5 days later, and by the League of Nations on September 29, 1922. And so the official interpretation of the British mandate was that all the territory to the west of the Jordan River was the area for the Jewish national home. Now, what about the operation of the mandate, the practical operation of the mandate under Britain? When Britain assumed responsibility for the Holy Land, it took over an economic cripple. Britain's initial efforts in Palestine during the first 2 years of occupation were devoted simply to restoring a minimal degree of law and order. Perhaps the mandatory single most impressive accomplishment was the establishment of an honest and efficient judicial system. The mandatory administration expended a lot of effort and time and talent on fostering agriculture. This sector of the economy the Turks had ruinously neglected. The government's agricultural department established research stations for improving cultivation and improving livestock. And with this help, the ravages of cattle plague, the ravages of locusts, the fruit flies were markedly reduced. Wide-ranging improvements in communication were accomplished by enlarging the rail network. The mandatory built roads and bridges. They modernized and augmented postal telegraph and telephone services. Air links were established with Europe. Air links were established to the Middle East. An international airport was constructed at Lydda. And there was a spectacular rise in the Jewish population since 1917. In 1917, it went from 55,000 to 103,000 by 1925. 55,000 at the end of the war to 103,000 by 1925. And much of this Jewish progress and growth was the result of Zionist enterprise alone. Even so, the Zionist enterprise benefited in a markedly measurable degree from the quality of peace, the quality of order, the quality of justice, and administrative integrity provided by the British mandatory government. They were extremely helpful in bringing order to Palestine after World War I was over. Also in this year, 1922, we have the death of Eliezer ben Yehuda, the founder of the modern Israeli Hebrew, died. In 1923, the mandate was confirmed by the League of Nations. So the League of Nations continued to support a Jewish national home, even though now it was, of course, limited to the west bank of the Jordan River. In 1924, we come to the Fourth Aliyah. In 1924, the population of the land was augmented by an unexpected and sizable influx of Jewish people from Poland. The Polish government had nationalized industry and commerce in those areas of industry and commerce in which Jewish people were most heavily represented, and then they dismissed the Jewish employers in favor of Polish workers. As a result, one-third of the nation's Jewish merchants were driven to bankruptcy. 33% of Poland's Jewish businesses were driven to bankruptcy, and emigration from Poland became their only hope. So between 1924 and 1928, 70,000 made their way to Palestine. And so the Fourth Aliyah, which began in 1924, raised the Jewish population of Palestine from 84,000 in 1922 to 154,000 in 1929. Now, the Fourth Aliyah immigrants generally gravitated to cities and towns. There they set up duplicates of the enterprises that they had left behind, the small businesses that they had left behind. So the newcomers of the Fourth Aliyah laid the basis for the Yishuv's urban economy. Within 5 years, they doubled the Jewish population of Jerusalem and Haifa. In that year, Technion was opened in Haifa as well. In 1925, the Hebrew University began in Jerusalem. In 1927, Achad Ha'am died, and the roots of self-government were laid down. In July of 1927, the government issued an ordinance which formally recognized a single Jewish community, the Knesset Yisrael, with its own religious and secular organs. And so the roots of self-government were now firmly planted in the land. Now we come to 1929, when we encounter some more Arab riots in Jerusalem. In 1929, the Arab restlessness had continued to grow, and as it happened, violence was ignited in a very unexpected location in the old city of Jerusalem, where Jews and Arabs had been living in close proximity for quite a number of centuries. The tension reached the boiling point on August 24th. At noon, an Arab mob attacked the Orthodox Jewish quarters, and the violence sped rapidly to other areas of Palestine. In late afternoon, Arab bands descended on the Orthodox Jewish community of Hebron, murdering 60 and wounding 50 more inhabitants. Other assaults were carried out in Haifa, in Jaffa, and even in Tel Aviv, and numerous Jewish agricultural villages were similarly attacked. Order was not restored until August 28th, 5 days later. By then, 133 Jewish people had been killed and 399 wounded. The Arabs had suffered 178 casualties, of which 87 had been killed. The High Commissioner rushed back from England and issued a proclamation on September 1st that condemned the Arab atrocities. He then proceeded to levy heavy collective fines on Arab towns and villages. However, the effect of these measures were soon dissipated. Quickly the Mufti protested the High Commissioner's brutality. He said that these were brutal disciplinary actions. And the High Commissioner then issued a second proclamation a few days later, stating that an inquiry into the conduct of both sides would be held as soon as possible. In response, the Jewish community was appalled at the implication that the murderers of and the victims were somehow on a common level, and they turned to London with complaint. In 1930, we come to the Shah Report. This was a critical moment in the Yishuv's fortunes. The Zionists learned to their dismay that they no longer enjoyed the backing of a sympathetic government in England. Ramsay MacDonald was now the Prime Minister. The colonial secretary was Lord Pasfield. MacDonald himself had visited Palestine in 1922, and he returned declaring that British promises to Jews and Arabs were contradictory. Weizmann soon discovered which way the wind was blowing when he reached London. For the first time in his experience, the Zionist leader encountered a chill wind. He was unable at the outset to secure an interview with Pasfield, the colonial secretary. When Pasfield finally received Weizmann, he bluntly declared himself opposed to mass Jewish immigration into Palestine. That was just the beginning. Other shocks were in store. In mid-September, the colonial office dispatched a royal commission to Palestine to inquire into the immediate causes which had led to the recent outbreak in Palestine and to make recommendations as to the steps necessary to avoid a recurrence. Now, the chairman of this commission was Sir Walter Shaw. The commission conducted its hearings over a period of 5 weeks and finally issued a report on March 31, 1930. It found the Arabs responsible for the violence. The commission went on to state that the fundamental cause of the tragedy was, quote, Arab feeling of animosity and hostility toward the Jews consequent upon the disappointment of their political and national aspirations and fear for their economic future. The mandatory administration was urged to tighten its control of Jewish immigration, protect Arab tenants from eviction by Jewish land purchasers, and ensure that the Jewish agency understood henceforth that it was in no sense empowered to share in the government of Palestine. So they said basically, the Shaw report, limit Jewish immigration, limit Jewish land purchase, limit Jewish government. The Shaw report aroused consternation among the Zionists and jubilation among the Arabs. In May, London dispatched Sir John Hope Simpson to Palestine. Hope Simpson embarked upon 3 months of travel and investigation. He did aerial surveys of the landholdings. Then he issued a massive 185-page report of his own on October 20, 1930. It was Hope Simpson's conclusion that the land available to Arabs was less than previously had been believed. The Arabs, he said, gradually had been driven off the soil by Jewish land purchases and the Jewish National Fund policy of not reselling to Arabs or allowing them employment on Jewish tracts. He felt that this was a distinct breach of the mandate. So further measures should be taken, he advised, to restrict both Jewish immigration and Jewish land purchases. The Zionists, shocked and angered, were not tardy in rejecting Hope Simpson's data and his conclusions. His attempt to blame Jewish immigration on Arab village poverty was libelous and inflammatory. In contrast, there had been a dramatic rise in Arab living standards as a consequence of the Jewish settlements. The irrefutable evidence was that Arab immigrants, no less than Jewish immigrants, were flooding into the company. Why? Into the country. Why? As a result of new economic opportunities provided by the Jewish national home. That's why the population of the area was rising. Arab and Jewish population were both increasing because of the economic opportunities that were being developed by the Jewish national home. Before these arguments could be marshaled, London released an official statement on the same day, October 20th. They released an official statement on the same day that the Hope Simpson report was published. It took the form of a 23-page white paper issued by Lord Pasfield. And the document proceeded to skewer virtually every Zionist hope for the future. For example, it stated, quote, "There remains no margin of land available for agriculture development by the new immigrants, with the exception of such undeveloped lands as the various Jewish agencies hold in reserve. Jewish immigration must be suspended too," they said, "as long as extensive unemployment in Palestine continued." The Pasfield White Paper appeared to repudiate the very purpose for the Balfour Declaration and the terms of the San Remo Award. Well, I can see our time is drawing to an end for lesson number 8. So we'll bring lesson number 8 to a close. We'll pick up lesson number 9 as we continue to look at the Pasfield White Paper and its impact upon the establishment of the modern state of Israel.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's H-A-D-A-V-A-R at hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.